The people, the industry has a record of having problems with the police and gangsters, but not during that general strike of 1933, because the industry was shut down not only in Chicago, but throughout the nation.
Oh, I see.
The industry was completely shut down. The negotiations really were going on in Washington, much more than with the individual industry.
I see.
The standard was set for the entire nation. 35-hour work week, certain standards of price settlement, etc. So it was a national, as far as the industry was concerned, it was a general strike throughout the nation. Therefore, there was no need to employ police. There was no place to go for them.
Wouldn't have done them any good.
No. There were no, today we don't call them scabs, we call them loyal employees. But at that time, all the employees must have been, and they were disloyal against their condition. So there was no need for the police.
Is the general strike then what, I understand that the union like trebled in membership in 1934?
Between 1926 and 1933, the ILG had what we call today the Joint Action Fight, which was a great inner struggle within the union. The militant workers who had helped to organize the union since 1910 mm-hmm. and 1912 and 1913 really had a socialist background and wanted the union to be a union that's concerned not only about its economic conditions, but to raise their standard of living, to get the people out of the ghettos, whether it was the Italian or the Jews mm-hmm. in New York and the others.
More of a moral question.
More, in addition to the economic,
right.
I wouldn't say more, but in addition to the economic, it was a moral fight. And it was the last section, these immigrants that came here during the last 19th century, who have helped build the union, who came here and viewed with a spirit of socialism and revolution, who fought very bitterly to have that kind of a union. But it came in also some of 1926 and 30, the union became practically completely in without any influence. In fact, in Chicago at that time, see, the New York office, where it had the national office, was able to maintain a face of union, even though they had a shop for the president and couldn't get any. But in Chicago, for instance, when those of us that were union conscious, out of our own meager wages, we paid one person wages so that she should be able to leave work several hours a day and sort of maintain a face of union. Mm-hmm. To that degree, the union has lost its influence between these years.
Right. And the general strike then brought it back.
And in 1933, when the union finally settled the agreement, a national agreement, problems arose once again mm-hmm. of leadership in the union.
Now, is that when David Dubinsky, is that his
name? David Dubinsky took on, and the need for a president in the union was at such a low ebb that nobody wanted to take that on. But David Dubinsky said, who was a cutter,
mm-hmm.
a one section of the trade, said, he'll take on the presidency, provided he will also be given the office of general secretary.
Now, what is the general secretary?
The general secretary actually is the key,
the power
for the union. It's finances, it's everything else. Which, under that leadership, turned the union from its... The union paper, which is Justice, which is being issued until today,
mm-hmm.
when I joined the union in 1933, the message of the Justice was, workers of the world unite, that was still the influence of the immigrant workers that had helped build the union.
Right.
But shortly after that, under the really one-arm rule of Kubinsky, the union gradually changed.
Became more conservative?
It became more conservative. Became, even though the union, the IFG, together with the Amalgamated, were one of the unions that had joined the CIA, formal organization. But who left it? Because the CIA was too radical for them. Who left it? It was through the policy of the day today, which is establishment.
Now, the difference between Amalgamated and the International is that the Amalgamated is the men's clothing industry.
And the International is women, not only dress the suits and clothes, but all its allies, which is food, preserves, and underwear, and all of that. But the difference in the two unions is greater than that, than this composition. It is under Hillman's leadership, who was, until he died, and then Frank Rosenblum took over, who was the leader of the Amalgamated Union, politically, even though it was also not one of the high-paid unions, but one of the lower-paid unions. But philosophically and ideologically, it was much more in step with the movement of progress of unions generally than the IFG. And this period, there is an attempt to join, to amalgamate both unions. It may be far off yet, I doubt it, but there are steps being taken on certain issues.
Did the New Deal and the National Recovery Act really change conditions?
It changed conditions tremendously. Number one, the primary reason why it had to change conditions is because there has been an upsurge of union organization. Because for the first time in the history of the United States, Roosevelt had sort of placed it as a mandate that workers should organize into unions, you know, that they must in order to make conditions. And and the mere fact that there was a shorter work week and the New Deal brought in many innovations. And even though the benefits may not have occurred or were evident immediately, but it was an upsurge into union organization in the beginning. Then there was, you know, the WTA, which absorbed so many workers. And the outside of the union, where the people had these counters and unemployment, and the struggle for unemployment insurance really took on an impetus after that. This encouraged the workers, you know, on one hand, the right to organization, where they felt, even though there was a struggle with the union leadership for the Unemployment Insurance Act. But nevertheless, it has uplifted the workers, gave them a new spirit, both in the struggle for their life and in union organization.
Did you start working as an organizer soon after that?
I have told you previously that when I found in 1932 that I had to go to work, I joined the Industrial Union.
Yeah.
In 1933, the Industrial Union, which was a not only the ILG for the first, had many other unions, but the union leadership at that time felt that it is of value and importance to the workers to join this great general strike and become part of one great union. And they had, in Chicago, in New York they done it later, but in Chicago they closed up the dress department during the general strike. Naturally, I came in 1933 to the ILGW with a background of struggle and understanding union struggle. And the union at that time needed leadership, tremendous leadership. It was a union. It began to organize itself. And in Chicago, after about a year after 1933, and in the meantime, those of us that came in from the industrial union, we were constantly on the alert to see that the gains that were done in 1933 that were made, that they should be retained, which is not that easy because it's peculiar to the industry, which I tried to say. It's an industry that constantly you have to negotiate with your employer in order to maintain a certain standard. So I have developed a certain reputation of being a militant worker, of a person that knows how to struggle within the shop to maintain conditions mm-hmm. on the basis of our agreement. And once again, the union, the Yalit at that time, who was the manager of the Local 100, of which I was a member, called me in and offered me the following. A 3-year study at Chicago University. All my expenses, and they knew that I had a child to take care of, all my expenses paid for. Able to take care of my child and all my economic needs. At the end of the 3 years, any office that I would want in the IOG that I would be able to get. And my reputation, as I say, has been there already. And they said, because I was quiet, I didn't answer. And he says, well, you wouldn't have to do anything, he says. You just wouldn't have to advocate your principles. Which sort of, while I was hesitating, and I didn't think I would take it to begin with, but that sort of put me off. You know.
The union called you in?
Yes. Mr. Bialik, mm-hmm. who was manager at that time, he retired only recently. He was manager at the local union.
Mm-hmm. Were you too radical for them?
Well, they knew my reputation.
Right.
But look, many times as I got older, I am thinking, should I be sorry for not taking that? Because there were certain very good things. The ability of going to school for 3 years and learn academic education, which I found throughout my life, which I found that a hindrance in many of the things that I wanted to do. And secondly, I was thinking, wouldn't it have been possible for me, being an officer of the union, to do much more for the people in the shop than being just a militant worker in the factory. So while these troubled me at one time, nevertheless, I look back at history and I see it's just not possible in a union that has a certain policy for the individual, is not possible to pursue a different policy.
Right.
It's either you're part of that or you're not. So as I say, that I'm mixed feelings. But I do, for instance, not being sorry for whatever, but just thinking opportunities in this great country are less and certainly available, but there's always a price to pay.
That's right. I was going to ask you if your socialist beliefs ever got in the way
yes.
of union activities.
No, they did not get in the way of union activities, but my union felt that I was in their way. And I've had many struggles with the leadership of the union. In Chicago, I was called, for instance, for reading socialist literature. And at that time, I subscribed to the Worker, which was the publication of the Communist Party. And I was on trial by the union,
mm-hmm.
on trial. My defense was that I have a right to read them, but it's true, I read that paper. But I read many others, which incidentally was also true. But I read many other periodicals, that I'm a person that is concerned about not only my immediate needs, but generally. And they never, however, were successful in denying me membership of the union. The reason for it was is because I was not the only one. There were many of us, militant workers, that maintained conditions in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
So while the workers may not, and I would like to modify that word "may not," but they definitely didn't, the subsequent years group, did not support me on my ideological or political outlook, but supported me on the basis of the activity in the union work, in the constant struggle to maintain conditions in line with the agreement. And that was a certain period. In 1941, I left Chicago. And I, during the war years, 1941 and 1946, I lived in New York because my daughter wanted to be a union at that time. And already then, the struggle was sharp within the union. And it wasn't until 1946 when I came to Los Angeles that I became an officer of the union, simply because right after the war, the industry began to grow in Los Angeles. And it has become a very important center for the industry. And there was an influx of people into the factories and shops and the need of officer in the union. Once again, I was called in and offered a business agent, which the duties of a business agent in our union were service the people in the factory and help organize the unorganized, which I welcomed very much. But my lack of Spanish, not only being able to speak Spanish, but not even understanding Spanish, I realized as soon as I accepted that job that it is not possible for me to service the people in the factories because I couldn't understand their complaints. And they also felt inhibited in voicing complaints to me because, for which I never blamed the people, lack of confidence. Lack of confidence that I was not going to bear this. I came to my union and said, I will remain as an organizer, but I cannot be a business agent, that I would resign my job on one condition, that a Spanish-speaking person be put in my place, which the union did. And for the first time in the IRG in Los Angeles, I believe it was in 1947, Angelita Torres became business agent in Los Angeles, and
she was the first Spanish-speaking
woman,
the first woman,
the first woman, and the first Spanish-speaking woman that became organizer, that became business agent. The organizers, however, were not paid functionaries. We worked, and after working hours, since we worked only 35 hours a week, we did organizing. You see, so I had remained an organizer, part of the organizing committee, till I had retired.
And you did, and you organized, did you organize in Chicago too before you came?
Oh yes. I have always helped to maintain this, but as I say, the organizers, they are paid today.
They are.
Today the organizers are paid, and I'm very happy to say that today the ILG in Los Angeles has many, well, the word many is relative.
Yes.
When you had previously only one, and you have six or seven today, there are many. But they do have black, Spanish-speaking men and women on the payroll, full-time organizers.
Were you ever involved in other kinds of activities outside the union? The film that we were talking about before Union Made, they talked about rent strikes and helping workers from being evicted and things like that, and I was wondering if you were involved in things like that.
Yes. It was possible for me to do these things because after my husband left, I moved in with my parents. So I didn't have that drive or the urgency to immediately after work to go home. I knew that my child was taken care of. having the kind of a parents that I had, and especially my mother, Dad was more. In fact, she encouraged us to do other things. Mm-hmm. Therefore, and since a 35-hour week in those days was a tremendous thing, we used to start working early, and I know at 3:30 I was through with work, which made it possible for me to do many, many other things. I was politically motivated, in addition to mm-hmm. doing it. And therefore, I had participated in many struggles. I had helped the, whatever there was strike, I would help them. Because a strike is not that simple that you have workers out of work and this is it. No. Families have to be taken care of. To guarantee that one will not be forced to go into work before the agreement is signed because of shameless economic necessity or illness or many other things. Therefore, there's constantly need of participating in that kind of activity, which to me it always was not only an economic struggle, but it was a struggle for political advancement mm-hmm. of the people. Therefore, now, during the, particularly during the Second World War, and prior to the Second World War, because I was in Chicago, yes, in this country, with the advent of Hitlerism in Germany, there was a tremendous movement of its name was, it was an anti-fascist movement, the struggle against war and fascism, mm-hmm. in which I was very active and gave it, during those years, gave it tremendous, most of my time.
Maybe we could just sum up by kind of talking about the quality of life and living conditions during the Depression and whether or not those conditions became better with a better working condition in the factories or...
During the late 20s, in the very early 30s, conditions were very bad. Bad in the sense that unemployment grew constantly. People had lost most of their savings. People weren't unable to maintain the payments on their homes, if not that they left their homes. Evictions came in as a mode of life, not that the people instituted, but it was instituted against the people. And several evictions took place daily in the city of Chicago, where I lived at that time. And once again, the individual was unable to do anything against it. And the people rallied, and there was a constant struggle. The sheriff would come with papers and put the things on the street in a sense, the neighbors and the people that realized that they must rally to one another because no one knew who's going to be evicted next. They rallied to them and put the things back, and there was a constant, it was a daily struggle. Many people were hurt during these struggles. Particularly the struggles that shot on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Struggles with the police?
With the police. In one eviction incident on the south side, three black people were killed because of the eviction struggle trying to put the things back. And I remember very vividly, and just to illustrate the humane attitude of the people from one to another, that 110,000 people came to the funeral of these three black people that were evicted.
To show their solidarity.
To show their solidarity. That blew up a tremendous feeling of people that they must stay together, which in my opinion helped the great organization for unemployment insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And then Roosevelt came in, his moratorium against the bank in order to stop these mortgage foreclosures, opening up various WPA camps for people, which took away some of the unemployed. the another party among payments of mortgages, etc., and many other public work which was instituted by the federal government began gradually to change that not the struggles of the people, but to change the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe it was the 1936 when the first unemployment checks came through. And then shortly after that, with the danger of war coming, starting out in Western Europe, with Germany advancing and mobilizing the troops, Roosevelt recognized that during these unemployment years and during the depression of the country has neglected its defense apparatus. And with the beginning of building national defense, one really seems to get to change economically in this struggle. And certainly in 1939 and 40, when the war really started in Europe, and we began to supply the countries who eventually became our allies because of our participation in that war, of supplying them with materials in order to be able to beat off the fascist onslaught, that's when things really changed, in the fact that we had millions of soldiers which took them out of the workforce,
mm-hmm.
and placed them in the army. That is really when the change began to take place, is the beginning of the Roosevelt administration first instituting various people's programs, you know, building the WPA camps and the moratorium on old payments. That was a gradual rise of conditions, of improvement of conditions, until during the 41 and 46, and especially in 42, since we got involved actively in the war, these were the most profitable years in our nation, the most successful ones, the economically most successful. Which I do not want to leave the impression that it has to take a war in order to improve conditions. The problem is not to allow conditions to deteriorate so bad that only such aggressive measures could support.
Were the unions treated a lot more kindly towards the end of the 30s?
The union, during the war, the unions had a slogan, "All Out for Defense,"
mm-hmm.
which helped in the later years of the powers that be to take advantage of the unions. Because during the war years, there were no economic struggles. Everybody felt, because of the understanding that fascism was a threat not only to the European countries, but if fascism would succeed, it will dominate also our country. The people's efforts were involved with all their energies, and they really made the greatest contribution to mm-hmm. the war effort. Even though there was a slogan at that time, a national slogan of equality of sacrifice, needless to say, the great sacrifice that was made by the people, because the war manufacturers and the armament dealers, they have continued making their profits. Nothing stopped them. But the slogan of national sacrifice for the war effort, really, with all due credit to the people. And I think that there is nothing that we can say that can pay greater tribute to the people of our country than their sacrifice to help defeat